Russian President Vladimir Putin prepares to host African heads of state.
Main goal is to show to the international community that Russia is not alone.
Plus, what was Vladimir Putin doing during Yevgeny Prigozhin's rebellion? And what was he failing to do?
Putin was paralyzed and could not act decisively, and the upper reaches of leadership in Moscow were not giving orders down to the local level of military commands and security forces.
And later in the program, despite the shelling and attacks from Russian forces, a dedicated group of volunteers is going into danger to rescue animals. Today is Wednesday, July 26th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Vladimir Putin is preparing to host African heads of state in St. Petersburg in a few days. What is he hoping to achieve, and what message will his guests bring? For more, I'm joined by VOA's Ricardo Marquina in Moscow.
The main goal is to show to the international community that Russia is not alone, that perhaps they lost the support of European countries. They are isolated from the Western countries, but they still have good relations with not only with China, so with Africa, and pointing in that Africa is not supporting only Putin and his internal politics in Russia, but also the aggression against Ukraine. This is the main goal. Of course, African countries, not all of them support what Russia is doing in Ukraine, but they don't have special reasons to have bad relations with Russia. So Putin is playing with this need, especially the need that of these countries to have good prices for fertilizers from Russia and also for Russian grain.
Well, that was going to be my next question, is that since the dissolution of the Ukraine grain deal, the Black Sea grain deal, food prices, grain prices are going up. And I would think that some of the African leaders wouldn't be too happy about that.
Yeah, sure, and especially Russia is attacking especially the Ukraine infrastructures for grain, not only grain but also all the infrastructure necessary to export. So it's obvious that Russia is targeting this to provoke an increase in prices, because this increase in prices, I think already we are around the 12% of in grain and in corn. So it make his position to negotiate more stronger. So especially because Russia is telling all this time, Russia tells that his grain, the Russian grain, is in a not official embargo. So there are not sanctions against Russian grain, but Russia says that there are no official embargo to his production. So Russia wants to sell the Russian grain without any bureaucratic barriers. So one of the major points of Russia to be back to the grain agreement between Ukraine, Turkey, and Russia is to the end of this not official embargo against the Russian grain. This is the official position of Moscow. Of course, we can debate if that is true or is not true, but Russia is playing this card, the card of the increase in prices in the food markets to make pressure to the international community.
Now, a few weeks ago, Cyril Ramaphosa, the president of South Africa, led a delegation to Moscow to meet with Putin to discuss ending the war in Ukraine. Is that something that will be discussed at this summit?
I'm sure that in some point we will have some kind of a very vague declaration, especially from the country, for the African countries, that they have not interest in this war at all. But I don't expect any big words from Moscow, from Putin himself, or from his government. And Russia is determined to win this war mano militari. So in Moscow, there are only one way, is to win the war, or to lose it. But there are not any time that someone bring the question to go to the table to negotiate. Russia say always the same. Now is not the time for negotiation. And this is still true right now. Russia don't want to negotiate, want to win this war one way or another.
Ricardo Marquinho reports for the Voice of America. He's in Moscow. Ricardo, thank you for your time today. Thank you for your reporting.
Thank you very much.
A Ukrainian assault brigade has published video on Wednesday that it said shows its infantry securing positions near Bakhmut. VOA was not able to confirm the date or location the video is filmed. The Ukrainian military on Tuesday reported making small advances against Russian forces in parts of southern Ukraine and south of Bakhmut in the east. In a counteroffensive launched early last month, Kyiv is trying to drive the Russian forces back in eastern Ukraine and to advance towards the southern coast to sever a land bridge between Russia and Russian-occupied Crimea. From the battleground to the hospital, where the horrors of war arrive through the night at an emergency room in eastern Ukraine, a procession of stretchers bearing limp bodies whisked from the front line. The AP's Lawrence Brooks reports.
The soldiers come with bandaged limbs soaked in blood, faces blackened with shrapnel fragments, and stunned eyes fixed on the ceiling. Frozen in shock. Lately, they've been coming with ever greater frequency. A serviceman with a gaping thigh wound shrieks in pain as medical workers move him to a surgical gurney to have his leg amputated. By day, the Mechnikov hospital functions as normal, treating cancer patients and others with chronic diseases. But as evening comes, the pace of activity in the trauma room picks up, with wounded soldiers in desperate need of surgery arriving nearly every 15 minutes. And each night ushers in the same macabre routine. The injured arrive, many unconscious, and surgeons operate. The soldiers are then sent off to recover elsewhere to create space for the next nightly deluge. The hospital's chief doctor says, "It's a very difficult situation, but the fact that 95% of our soldiers recover is a better indicator. What else can you dream about? We try to do everything so that everyone who gets into trouble is sure to recover." I'm Lawrence Brooks.
As we've heard, Ukrainian authorities have announced territorial gains near Bakhmut, but of more immediate concern is the threat of incoming Russian jets. I'm joined by Anna Chernikova in Kyiv. Now, Anna, you and I have been talking to each other for a while now, and oftentimes when I talk to you, it's after an air raid that was happening overnight. Today's a little bit different. There's actually a warning going on in Ukraine right now. Can you tell us what the mood is in the city, what's happening, what people are expecting?
There is this high risk of possible missile strike, missile attack over Ukraine, and this was reported by the Ukrainian Air Forces. Air Force reported that 13 battle jets are Russian battle jets are now in the air, and even launches of certain amount of cruise missiles were reported as well from the area of Caspian Sea. For the moment, we don't know exact amount of these missiles. However, air raid alarm is expected. It's not yet on, and air forces are asking people to be very careful today and to be on the alert because the risk of missile attack is high.
So what's the mood like in the city? Are people nervous? Are people scared?
Well, no, I think that this is something that people are is getting used to every day more and more. Unfortunately, life is just going on. People just continue their daily activities and their working day is still ongoing. I cannot say that there is certain difference in the activities, but or in the reactions. But people just understand that they have to, they have to plan their day ahead.
Well, I know I wouldn't be as calm if I had Russian battle jets heading towards my city. Anna, we hope you stay safe. Changing the subject a little bit, moving on to another part of the war, the Ukrainian Armed Forces released some video footage and a statement today saying that they've recaptured some land near Bakhmut. Can you give us the latest?
So for a couple of days now, there were talks around this, and today it was actually confirmed that that Ukrainian forces had a certain advance in the area of Bakhmut. The advance is continuing, and the active actions, active battles continue, and Ukrainian forces had success and continue this success. This is what was confirmed by the general staff.
And along with the news of retaking some land, came news of a new kind of drone that the Ukrainian forces have added to their arsenal. What's the story there?
Actually, also for a couple of days now, there are talks inside the country about a new type of drones that were tested in Ukraine, which basically have artificial intelligence on board, let's put it this way, and they can continue being in action even if geolocation radars are down. And for the moment, we have confirmation from the Minister of IT Development of Ukraine that Ukrainian forces at the front line will get 1,700 new drones. And this amount will include certain part of this new drones with artificial intelligence.
And we'll certainly look forward to hearing more about the new drones once they're being used. I think we'll leave it here for today. Anna Chernikova in Kyiv. Anna, as always, thanks for your time today.
Thank you, Steve.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Karish. When Wagner mercenary group chief Yevgeny Prigozhin led his rebellion last month, one of the most stunning things the world saw was Vladimir Putin's silence. For more, I'm joined by Washington Post reporter Shane Harris to learn what Putin was doing and not doing and why.
Well, what we found was that in this period, this we'll remember this kind of like head-spinning 36-hour period where Prigozhin is taking a column up a highway towards Moscow after having seized control of a major military headquarters in southern Russia, that Putin was paralyzed and could not act decisively, and the upper reaches of leadership in Moscow were not giving orders down to the local level of military commands and security forces. And essentially what you saw was, as this rebellion is moving towards Moscow, Putin and the Kremlin really finding themselves unable to respond to it, and a kind of a silence that was really telling. And sources that we talked to said, you know, that Putin had time to take a decision to try and quell this rebellion, but that didn't happen. And we can talk about maybe some of the reasons it didn't, but it really revealed to a lot of our intelligence sources this inability of Putin to act quickly and act decisively in the face of this crisis, and raised real questions, I think, about the strength of his leadership and how much control he really even has over the military.
Well, how do we know it was indecision? There's a difference between not doing anything and deciding to wait to do something.
Yeah, I think that from what our intelligence sources are seeing is both that they understood, the Russian leadership understood, that Prigozhin was about to mount some kind of an attack. And in fact, in the days before, started fortifying areas in Moscow, including around the Kremlin. So you saw them taking steps to prepare for something. The question of exactly, you know, why Putin didn't move on them, one theory that we've heard from people, it comes down to the thought that Putin had that he couldn't really afford to completely try to eliminate the Wagner group because of the central role that it has played in the war in Ukraine, and that Prigozhin himself is somebody who is so tied in with the Russian elite and the establishment that he's a formidable adversary to Putin, and that this may explain why it is that Prigozhin, that Putin sort of waited at an alarmingly long time, I think, in a lot of of some people, maybe in Moscow. Precisely how this deal then gets orchestrated for him to stand down, why Prigozhin does so and makes this deal with the government of Belarus, that is still a bit of a mystery here. But the lack of communication that was coming from the Kremlin to these local authorities on what to do, and that kind of silence, I think that was very telling to the officials that we spoke to, who are, you know, still sorting through this too.
And has that had, or will it have, any long-lasting impact on either Putin's reputation or his ability to lead going forward?
Yeah, I mean, analysts that we've talked to and officials think that it will. You know, obviously, he is still in power. We should be very clear about that. And there are some indications that people who may have been sympathetic to Prigozhin or potentially even aware of what he was going to do have not been seen. They may be being detained. So Putin is still in charge here. But this was the most significant challenge to his authority since he has been the leader of Russia. And most people we talk to feel that it does leave him weakened. It shows that he didn't exercise as strong a leadership as they thought that he should, and also that he could be potentially vulnerable, maybe to another attempted mutiny by Prigozhin or other people who would like to challenge him. So Putin, you know, while he is in command here, I think comes across looking weaker for it.
Is it fair to say that Prigozhin's rebellion, because Prigozhin was friendly with some of the other folks in the defense ministry, was sort of critical of Putin for not being strong enough in the war with Ukraine, critical towards Putin for not being tough enough? And we've seen other critics of Putin from the left who are against the war, they go to jail, but the ones in the military system seem to be left alone.
Yeah, I think it is fair to say that Prigozhin has been critical of Putin for not going strong enough in Ukraine. I mean, he kind of has two major complaints that really come down to the conduct of how the war is being waged. One has been that his own forces, he has said, were not being adequately supplied by the Ministry of Defense. And also, you know, he has basically said that the generals and the ministers prosecuting the war are incompetent, and has urged them to go harder and to make more of a show of force. So he has really questioned not just the way the war is being waged. He's even gone so far as to question whether or not the war was even necessary. I mean, in a very remarkable address that he put out on Telegram in the days before this rebellion, you know, he said basically there was no real threat from Ukraine. What you're being told, Russian people, what you're being told by your leaders is not accurate. I mean, almost saying that they were sort of suckered into a war. That goes right to the kind of the rationale that Putin laid out for starting this military campaign more than a year ago. So for Prigozhin to criticize not just the way it's being waged, but sort of the premise of the war was extraordinary, and I think is read as directly as a shot at Putin, even though he kept insisting publicly that his beef was with the military leadership and the defense ministry.
But some of Putin's critics on the left said some of those exact same things and have ended up in jail.
That's right, because I don't think that they're a part of the power structure in Moscow. You know, when you have people like Prigozhin, who are very tied into the Russian elite, who commands a mercenary force of tens of thousands of fighters that are, I mean, indispensable, really, have proven to be for the Russian military campaign. I think he can afford to say some things that people on the left that lack that comparable power and kind of, you know, in status cannot easily say.
Shane Harris is a writer on national security for The Washington Post. He's based here in Washington, D.C. Mr. Harris, thank you very much for your time today. Thanks for your analysis.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
As we've heard, Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu was one of the targets of Prigozhin's rebellion. In a rare public appearance, Shoigu turned up Wednesday in Pyongyang. VOA's Steve Miller has more.
a Russian delegation, led by Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu, arrived in North Korea to celebrate the 70th anniversary of Victory Day later this week in the communist state, according to the ministry. The delegation will be joining a group led by Chinese Communist Party Politburo member Li Hongzhong as the first such public visitors to the country since the start of the pandemic. North Korea celebrates the anniversary of the 1953 armistice, which brought an end to the war with South Korea. The anniversary events are expected to include a major military parade in North Korea's capital, Pyongyang. Steve Miller, VOA News.
The State Department says that a former American Marine freed from Russia last year has been injured while fighting in Ukraine. The AP's Ed Donahue has the story.
Trevor Reed got out of Russia in a prisoner swap.
That government is really sincerely evil. At all levels, from the top to the bottom.
A source tells the AP Reed was wounded several weeks ago in Ukraine. The State Department says he was taken to Germany for medical care. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre says Reed was not in Ukraine on behalf of the U.S.
Since the beginning of the war, we've been very clear. We have warned that U.S. citizens who travel to Ukraine, especially with the purpose of participating in fighting there, that they face significant risk.
Reed's presence in Ukraine could complicate U.S. efforts to win the release of two other Americans still detained by Russia. Ed Donahue, Washington.
And finally, today in Ukraine, even in the face of Russian shelling, some people are staying in cities to help rescue pets. A group of volunteers from Kharkiv is trying to help. Anna Kostachenko has their story.
These four puppies were saved from the town of Chasiv Yar in eastern Ukraine, located some 12 kilometers from recent fighting. Ruslan Horbal is one of the volunteers who is helping evacuate pets from the conflict zone.
When the war started, it became clear that I can be most useful here, helping evacuate pets from the combat zone.
This part of the Donbas region isn't occupied by Russian forces at this point. Volunteers, including Yarina Vintonyuk, are going to about 20 houses a day to rescue pets.
People are giving their pets away to get a better chance to evacuate themselves. But some are staying in the heavily shelled areas just because they don't want to leave their pets behind.
Injured animals are being taken to a vet clinic opened in Kharkiv in the fall of 2022.
It's safe because it's in the basement, it's well protected. Initially, we bought very basic equipment for these surgeries and, treatment to be conducted. And it was basically movable, and they had it in one location, then in another, just in an apartment, in like a kitchen. So eventually, once they found funding to actually get the place, they were able to establish there. So we've done more of like the medical side, and German PETA, I believe, was the organization that paid for the location.
Vytautas Židonis is a Lithuanian surgeon. He has been working in this clinic since December 2022. He intentionally moved to Ukraine after Russia invaded to help in the best way he could.
Best motivations, it was Russians. They did already a lot of problems in my homeland, in Lithuania. We were occupied for a long time,
Since the start of the war, rescuers have evacuated over 10,000 animals from the dangerous areas of Ukraine. Anna Kostichenko for VOA News, Kharkiv and Donetsk regions, Ukraine.
And that'll do it for us today. Stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day. Visit us online at voanews.com and on social media. Be sure to follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish.
This is the voice. of America. Washington, D.C.